Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Oh, God, this president is driving me nuts. I keep thinking that November can't come soon enough. But as I think of November, I need to remind you how we begin our show. We begin our show with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman at the impeachment hearing in 2019. I want his words and his voice ringing in your ears as you go into the voting booth, if that's how you vote. We may be voting by mail. Who the hell knows how we'll be voting. But I think it's really important that you remember Colonel Vindman. And now I'm going to add to that list and remember Wisconsin. But now, Colonel Vindman's testimony in November of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States, so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Although this is not Earth Day, in fact, we tape on Monday, and Earth Day is Wednesday. In a lot of ways, what we're talking about has to do with climate, the climate crisis, melting ice caps, all those things that should be a wake-up call that while Earth Day was an important event in 1970, it is not mission accomplished in any way, shape, or form. Joining me right now is Brian Kahn. He's a journalist covering climate change. He works at Earther, and it is a site where he is the managing editor. He holds a master's in climate and society from the Columbia University. And we were privileged in the state of New Hampshire to get to meet all the candidates who are running for president of the United States. And I mean all the candidates that were running, in excess of 20. One of those candidates was quite outstanding, especially if you care about climate. And it was Governor Jay Inslee. And Brian, you wrote a piece that was entitled, Jay Inslee's Climate Team Dropped a Roadmap for a Post-Coronavirus Green Recovery. So let's talk about the fact that he may no longer be in the race. He's not being considered by Joe Biden as his VP because we know it's going to be a girl. But more importantly, his people, I guess, went to work for Elizabeth Warren for a while. But then they put together this, I think, pretty interesting roadmap as to what to do. So let me welcome you to the program and tell me about this. I think you said it was an 80-page proposal, and they're hoping that one, Joe Biden might read it, and two, make him understand that this is not only important for our future, but it probably is also important if he wants to get a lot of the younger voters who are somewhat disappointed with a Joe Biden nominee. And this is an issue that's both crucial for them because they care about it passionately, but it's also crucial for them because it's really about their future, because I'm an old fart, but they have decades to go in a really challenged environment. So Wednesday is Earth Day. And while you will hear this interview on Tuesday, I think the whole idea of climate change, the environment is something that we can't walk away from, because if there's an urgency of the moment, the urgency is not just COVID-19. We knew even before COVID-19 that climate change was going to really sort of change the character of the world, change our approach to policy, and that we need to address it and address it quickly. So I went to Gizmodo, and there is a section called Earther. And joining us is Brian Kahn. Brian Kahn is the editor for Earther. And he wrote a piece about Jay Inslee's climate team dropped a roadmap for a post-coronavirus green recovery. And I went, huh, dropped a roadmap for who? And I went, of course, for Joe Biden. So let me welcome Brian Kahn to the program and ask him a little bit about this 80-page document. Who put it together? Obviously, this was the sort of raison d'etre for Jay Inslee's very short but important run for president. And while he may not have made it very far, the idea of climate change is not only important to him, but I think it's important to a significant base of the Democratic Party. So the idea of a roadmap, I think, is probably crucial, not only as we look at what's going to happen after the November election, but it's probably crucial, Brian, to Joe Biden if he wants to attract a certain base of the Democratic Party, who's a little bit sort of eyeball rolling about Joe and his commitment to a Green New Deal or to climate change. And this, I think, might be a vehicle for him to sort of take a look at and maybe even use as he moves into the November election. So welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. So tell me a little bit about, you know, this group, about the 80-page document. Where did they come from? And what does this actually propose?
Well, so Evergreen is a group of folks that have worked with Jay Inslee both, you know, at the state level in Washington and then on his federal campaign for presidency. After he dropped out, some of them moved over to the Warren campaign, either in informal and informal roles. And it sounds like, you know, they decided to get the band back together and create this new document that basically combines the best of Jay Inslee's plans, some of the best parts of Elizabeth Warren's plans, and puts it in the context of the new world we face, because of course, when these plans were made originally, you know, back in the summer of 2019, which feels like forever ago, we weren't really thinking about coronavirus. Now it's the thing that defines the next steps we take. And so that's what this document essentially lays out is, you know, what were the ideas that were put forward in these plans initially, and now how do they change, or how do they interlock with this new world and this new reality we face of one where there's a pandemic and this need for a green recovery with the way that sort of things are unfolding in the world around us today.
Okay, so that's wonderful. So tell me how they took this new world, the pandemic world of COVID-19, and they took the pieces that we sort of wrote when we thought that the urgency was, you know, the melting sea caps, and now it turns out that everything is melting, including the economy, including our healthcare system, including people's trust in anything. So how did they thread their understanding of the climate crisis with the pandemic? How did they blend the two or use our response to the coronavirus as a vehicle for explaining why these things that we need to do vis-a-vis the climate are even more essential than we thought last summer?
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing is that this, you know, with the coronavirus, so when, you know, the Green New Deal came out, when people were proposing these big climate plans, there was this question always of, you know, well, how are you going to pay for it? And it was always based on sort of a false premise. And I think what the coronavirus has shown is that, you know, when you need to do something, there is money there to do it. Exactly. You know, we unlocked $2 trillion to basically help in the sort of phase three section of the recovery with the coronavirus. And now we're thinking about phase four. Like, what does that look like? Who are we helping? Where's the money going? Those kinds of things. And so I think when you're looking at this plan that these folks have put together, there's the acknowledgement that, you know, we're going for another stimulus. I mean, the country needs another stimulus. There's no doubt about that. And there's also no doubt that we need to address climate change. And so when you're looking at this chance to sort of fix the things that are already broken, why wouldn't you take this opportunity of the coronavirus to, you know, fix them and fix them in a way that also helps the climate? And I think that that's sort of the beauty of this plan and a couple other proposals that have been put out there around a green stimulus, is that whatever we do to fix the coronavirus pandemic, we need to also think about how we fix the climate crisis, because they're interlocked.
Okay, so I'm kind of a jerk. And in my jerky way, I go to Facebook today because I see two stories and I connect the dots. One of the stories is about the tumbling price of oil. It's down to like $3 a barrel, okay? And I posted that on my Facebook page. And then I posted a really snarky comment from my good friend, Charlie Pierce. And Charlie Pierce writes, "Oh, good. I can go to the dollar store and buy a gallon of oil." You know, I mean, he's like, but the reason I even posted these two was that I was thinking, rather than bailing out fracking and oil and gas, here's an opportunity for us to maybe even buy them out, not bail them out, but buy them out and begin to sort of start by saying, how do we get off the oil teat? Begin to wean us off the oil teat, because now rather than bailing them out, we buy them out. And then we take all those workers and all those engineers and all that level of sophistication and put it into alternative energy and something sustainable, and recognize that these people have jobs or had jobs. We need to make sure that they continue being part of the vital economy. But this is a part of the vital economy that's actually harming the planet, let alone harming us. And maybe now is an opportunity for us to bridge into responding to the climate crisis, because now look at what's happening to oil, coal, and gas. I mean, it's gone to a large extent, but that doesn't mean that we won't revive it. But rather than revive it, maybe we need to think of something else.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we're at this point where, you know, and I think anyone that doesn't acknowledge the benefits that these workers that have, you know, given all of us by working in this industry and by making all the modern trappings that we have here possible. I mean, if you're not acknowledging them for doing that amazing job, then, you know, you are a jerk, actually. Luckily, it doesn't feel like you're that kind of jerk. You're a good-natured jerk.
Right.
But you do need to acknowledge that. But I think we also need to acknowledge the reality that these industries cannot exist in a world where we still have a habitable planet. And so it's on us to take care of those workers, and it's on us to also wind down those industries. And what you're looking at now with those prices that you mentioned, I mean, as we're talking now, oil is trading at negative prices right now. You're getting,
oh my God,
they're paying people to take oil, essentially, because it's just not that profitable. We've got this glut on the market. So, you know, there's no better time for the federal government to use the money it has at its disposal and the mechanisms it has to basically buy out some of these industries, take care of workers, and wind it down.
It really, and so someone was also, another snarky comment on my Twitter feed was some guy saying, remember when Donald Trump said, oh, I'm going to buy all this oil because I want to fill up our stockpiles. And he goes, and it's such a deal, it's only $31 a gallon. And I'm thinking, why didn't he wait? You know, I mean, look at this. but as I'm looking, so did they make those assumptions in this 80-page document? Were they sort of building bridges into how we can use what's happening with the pandemic as a vehicle for also transforming both the economy and our response to the environment? Because I really do think that, you know, I go back to 9/11, and 9/11 was such an incredible tragedy, but it really also was an incredible opportunity. We never exercised the opportunity. We only sort of massaged the tragedy. Now we're doing this with COVID-19, which has exposed so many vulnerabilities, so much more so than what we saw with the economic meltdown, so much more than we saw with 9/11. And if now is not the time to use this as an opportunity to rehabilitate, because going back is a disaster, given what we know about our future, and yet where we're living right now is a disaster, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that that's something that this plan acknowledges on both sides. I mean, it talks about, you know, ending the giveaways to the fossil fuel industry and taking a harder line on, you know, not just prosecuting the industries that are here in the U.S., but also, you know, petrostates that are kind of doing their own sort of thing by propping up dictators using this fossil fuel money. But I think, you know, the other thing that I love about this plan and some of the other green stimulus ideas I've seen is this idea that we also need to foster, you know, the good side of things, which means fostering clean energy. It means focusing on communities that, you know, need to have their lead pipes replaced, that need to be taken out of the shadows of refineries and given clean air to breathe. I think that that's, you know, when we're talking about what does a green recovery look like, it looks like both those things. It looks like, you know, winding down emissions, but also building up the things that can make us, you know, a healthier, stronger society as well.
Well, and I want to get into your second article as well, but so we know it's been delivered to Joe Biden. Do we know whether he's opened it up? Do we know about the environmental team around him? I'm kind of curious, because to me, he's still a blank slate. He was never a very good candidate. He's kind of like, he was this safe, neutral backdrop. And so everybody, because they were so terrified by Donald Trump, and in some ways so terrified by Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders was talking about the revolution, and Biden became kind of like the Obama third term. Well, even Obama says that if I were running again, I would not be running on what I ran on in 2008 or what I ran on in 2012, that there's no going back. So I'm kind of curious, from your vantage point, what do we know about Biden? He's got a sort of an interesting, you know, environmental position, but it's pretty tepid. Let's put it that way. Do we know whether he was willing to address it? Was he willing to bring on some of the Warren people, some of the Inslee people, onto his sort of staff in order to make sure that as he looks at the future, these people are not only important players when it comes to the climate crisis, but they're actually important players because they send a message to the voters that he needs that he is going to make change, and that it's not going to be tepid change, it's going to be real change.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting to see how this has all kind of played out. A lot of progressive green groups, like the Sunrise Movement, for example, put out a list of demands or things that they thought would be really helpful for Joe Biden to be won over their side to show he's serious. Because, you know, you're right, he's kind of this, I don't say he's quite a blank slate because he has a long history that we can sort of pluck apart. But
But the long, I hate to say that, but the long, he became whatever the environment was. So if the environment was, you know, pro-business, he became pro-business. If the environment was, you know, against crime, he became against crime. So I don't see him as a particular leader in anything. I do see him as a good follower of a lot of things. So now the question is, who is he following or what is he following? So that's why I'm kind of curious as to how receptive whatever his team is to looking at these environmental issues.
Yeah, I mean, having not talked to his team, I will say this, that, you know, I know that the group that put out this plan has been in touch with him. I know that, you know, a number of other people have been talking behind the scenes with them. And there's been talk about, you know, when Bernie Sanders came out and said, you know, all right, we're going to work with Joe on this. You know, one of the things that they set up was a working group on climate. So, I think there are these opportunities to push him. And in some ways, when you talk about him being, you know, somebody that's a good follower, I mean, I totally 100% hear what you're saying there. And I think that that also speaks to a major opportunity for green groups to push him and to get, extract, I mean, I don't want to call them concessions because having a livable planet is not really a concession, but of getting him to advance, you know, to push his plan to new heights, essentially. I think there's a real opportunity here if he wants their vote. And now is the time to be pushing for that.
And if I were a member of the African-American community, which clearly is the reason why he is the nominee, there's no question about it. Between Barack Obama and the congressman from South Carolina, there'd be no Joe Biden. But one of the things that we're learning, and again, I'm going to go back to the pandemic, is that who is suffering the greatest consequences? Who is dying more than any other group? Without a question, it is the African-American community. And it's not just because they are in worse health. It's not just because they may be lower income. It's also because they live in places that are incredibly polluted.
Yeah, okay? Absolutely.
And when you begin to look at air quality and pollution and the rollbacks under Donald Trump with the EPA, put more mercury in the air, you begin to realize that part of the reason he can also then appeal to the African-American base is that this alternative energy, this Green New Deal, is also about saving your life. More so than any other group in the United States. When you look at who's living outside of certain places in Houston, living outside certain places in New Orleans, you know who it is. And it isn't the white and the wealthy and the privileged, it's them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it speaks to the fact that it's a long process, right? Like you have to build that trust up. And clearly Joe Biden is offering from a base of trust with these communities based on the way that they voted for him. Clearly they believe in him. And I think that, you know, that is a really powerful starting point for him to potentially start to help build this coalition. I think environmentalists have been trying to do this outreach to, you know, disadvantaged communities of color, places that are poor. You know, it's been a very slow process because, frankly, the environmental movement hasn't always been great at doing that outreach.
I know.
The idea of making a coalition with the Joe Biden, you know, and Joe Biden, environmental group, community of color, Nexus, I mean, that's a really powerful voting block. And so, you know, it's up to him, I think, to sort of earn the trust of these environmentalists and then, you know, potentially leverage that into a much more interesting and powerful coalition.
Oh, God, Brian. So I'm an old lady. And in 1990, I think it was, or maybe 1989, I got an award from a group of environmentalists. And there's a picture of me in a magazine where I'm sort of leaning against a tree. And what I'm saying to the environmental community back then was, where are your coalitions? Who are you tying yourself to? How are you connecting the dots? It's not only about saving the birds. You know, it's not only about saving the open spaces. It's not only about wanting to shut down the plants because of air quality. It's addressing the issues of healthcare. It's addressing the issues of poverty. I said, if you start creating those coalitions, then the environment and protecting the environment won't seem so elite. Mm-hmm. It'll seem so necessary. This is like 1989, Brian. You know, and to hear you say they're not always good at making those coalitions, I want to scream because I'm like, oh my God, you know, get on the stick because now more than ever, we so need each other. And that's the power of this pandemic is that we're all in this boat together and we're beginning to realize the connections we have to each other, whether it's connections to frontline workers, whether it's connections to the environment, whether it's connections to needing government to be responsive. I think, again, it creates such an opportunity from a climate change perspective, which is why I hope Joe Biden reads this piece that was dropped last week. So before I let you go, though, you have to talk to me about the second piece. And I said to you before you came on the air that I'm interviewing two authors today, and that when I was reading your two pieces, the thing that came that sort of literally stuck in my brain was the concept of stuck weather. Now, what the hell am I talking about with stuck weather? You wrote a piece that's entitled, "Great, now we have to worry about sunny skies melting Greenland's ice sheet." So will you sort of enlighten my audience, literally enlighten my audience about the story of Greenland? Because I read this and I went, oh my God, there are so many consequences that we're not aware of and we're not following, that I think it's really important that you tell the story about the melting ice cap and the story of Greenland, because I want people to know we have no freaking clue to what's going on. And there are so many other pieces here that we either aren't following, but we need to be aware of.
Yeah, I mean, the Greenland ice sheet has just been kind of hanging out in the background of life, melting really fast, unfortunately for us. And, you know, last summer was a record melt for the Greenland ice sheet. It has never melted as much, both over the course of a summer and over the course of a couple days. There was one day where 12.5 billion tons of ice just melted. Because it was extremely hot, which was one big problem. But the other big problem was that it was just too dang sunny for Greenland. And so that was, you know, these weird confluences where we talk about climate change and we know the planet's heating up, right? And that's a really easy thing to understand. But then you have this intersection of weird stuck weather, which was the sunny skies, this high pressure system that just locked in over Greenland and kept clouds and storms from going over. And you have sun, you have heat, they start to reinforce each other and you get these record melt. And so that's what we saw happen last summer in Greenland. And, you know, I kind of laugh a little bit, but really it's, I laugh mostly because it's terrifying to think about the fact that, you know, that's one of the biggest stores of ice on the planet. It's melting. Well, and the fact that we saw the biggest melt ever last summer is just like, bleh.
Oh, I mean, I feel like it's, again, it's synergistic. You know, it's getting hotter, and then it's getting hotter because the sun is shining in a place that it normally doesn't shine because of this stuck weather. And you know what I thought of as I was listening to your, reading your piece about stuck weather? I thought of Houston and the hurricane, where it just didn't leave. It just kept raining and raining. It didn't leave. It just kept raining. And I kept thinking that was stuck weather. I mean, that was part of the problem. And you're right, we can't necessarily connect the dots to climate change. But what we know is we're having these wilder weather swings. We know that. We're seeing things like stuck weather in a way that we haven't seen before. And while you can't necessarily point your finger at climate change, you have to start wondering, even if it's not directly the cause, it only exacerbates what's happening as a result of climate change.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can sort of point the finger in some cases.
I know.
You know, if you look at the California drought that happened a few years ago, locked in for 4 or 5 years, I mean, similar thing, stuck weather. You look at the heat wave that hit Europe last year, same thing, stuck weather. And the way that this happens is actually because, you know, the poles are warming faster than the tropics. And so, you know, the jet stream, which is kind of this fast river of air that moves around the earth, usually it kind of just kind of flows in a straight line. But as you lose that temperature gradient on either side of it, those kind of pull it tight like a string. But as you, you know, sort of loosen the grip, it wobbles more. And that's what leads to these stuck weather patterns. So you actually can say in some cases, not every case, but that climate change and the rapid warming of the Arctic is directly tied to these bizarre stuck weather patterns we're seeing. So, you know, that's the world we live in now.
Okay, so here's the deal I need to make with myself, and I'm going to make it out loud so that you can hear it. And that is, Brian, so you write about climate. This is what you do at Earther. And I'm realizing that because of COVID-19, we've been COVID-19 24/7. We've been Donald Trump's pressers 24/7. We've been the dysfunctional government 24/7. We've actually put climate change on the back burner, but that is happening in a way parallel and a way as rapidly as this pandemic. And we can't not cover it because the pandemic hasn't stopped climate change. Well, in a way it sort of has a little bit because nobody's taking airplanes and nobody's driving their cars. And my daughter lives in Shanghai and she says she's never seen the sky before and she suddenly sees the sky, but it's important for us to make sure that we cover both, because if we cover both, we'll see the connection And then as we move forward, whether it's in the bailout or whether it's in the election of November of 2020, we understand that what has been exposed by the climate crisis, what has been exposed by the pandemic, are things that we have the capacity to fix. So I can't thank you enough for writing what you do. And I'm going to now have to start following you at Earther because it's going to be too important. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me and thank you for covering this.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Brian Kahn writes for Earther and he's their managing editor. Stick around, everyone. When we come back, we're going to be talking about gig workers and we're going to be talking about the shadow economy, obviously undocumented workers, and whether the government is figuring out how to do the bailout. All right, we'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 workers and injuring 17 more. The rig experienced an initial blowout, releasing an uncontrollable flow of oil and gas from the well. Hydrocarbons then ignited, causing the explosion and fire. It caused a massive offshore oil spill of over 4 billion barrels and is considered the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. British Petroleum was the main operator responsible for the well's design. The drilling contractor, Transocean, owned and operated the rig. A handful of smaller companies were also involved. While company and governmental officials initially argued the explosion was unforeseeable and then subsequently blamed each other, there were warning signs in the months leading up to the deadly explosion. Multiple equipment failures, design deficiencies, poor preventative maintenance, bad engineering decisions, and a chase for profits that emphasized low worker injuries at the expense of process safety all combined to create the disaster. As well, regulations and standards enforcement were weak in an almost totally deregulated industry. One phrase used by investigators to characterize the explosion was the normalization of deviance. From workers to managers to executives, none saw the explosion coming. There were dozens of contributing factors, as the Chemical Safety Board investigation noted. They listed 57 key technical, human, and regulatory factors in their 2016 final report. However, engineers had raised concerns about the potential failure of key equipment. Workers were sensitive to the fact that they could be fired for raising safety concerns that delayed drilling. BP was ultimately found responsible and racked up over $70 billion in fines, cleanup, and settlement costs. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Rich man can't get in to heaven, I'm told, but the way things are going, hell, I'll never know. Guess they'll let me right in. My daddy came back from Vietnam, spit on his face, a purple heart in his hand, and he tried to keep a steady job when he could. Mama says he ain't the same man. Well, the man on the news says it's all going down. There ain't a job around here to be found. Dying poor is my only fear. Food stamps came by me a bus ticket out of here.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes, my producer. Well, we love Henry Graybar. Why? Because he writes for a great site, Slate.com. He writes at Moneybox. And he always writes about things that I find both interesting and essential. A piece he wrote a couple of days ago was entitled, America Has Abandoned Its Shadow Workforce. And Henry, I talk about this a lot. Undocumented residents have lost their jobs. They're not getting government checks, but the bills keep coming. And as I was thinking about this, I mentioned to you just before you came on the air that we air in Houston, and Houston has 600,000 undocumented immigrants just in Houston alone. The state of Vermont is 600,000. I want people to put this into perspective, what we're talking about. And as I was thinking about how they're gonna respond to losing their jobs and not being able to get anything from maybe the unemployment rolls or not being able to get anything for that $1,200 check, I keep thinking, how are they going to eat? Because they don't get food stamps either. So talk to me about your piece and how you sort of documented both the tragedy and the challenge.
Well, I think obviously there is widespread economic devastation across the country right now, stemming from the coronavirus lockdowns. And I guess the good news is that Congress did pass this kind of pretty bold and unprecedented spending package that does, among other things, it boosts the federal unemployment assistance to $600 a week in addition to what you're getting from the state. So for people who lose their jobs, who are making $25,000 or $30,000, they might end up actually making more money on unemployment than they did before. And Republicans were very concerned about that, and they thought it would incentivize people to quit their jobs. I doubt that is the case or has been the case, but it is true that Congress has provided pretty ample assistance to people who lose their jobs, which is great news. Obviously, this does not include undocumented immigrants. There are 12 million of them in this country. Many have been here for decades. They do work that is
essential,
absolutely vital, from meatpacking plants to your local restaurant and grocery store. And they have virtually been left out of all the discussions in Washington. So, and I think they would say, and have said to me, that's nothing new for us. We are used to fending for ourselves here. But the scale of the lockdown is so unprecedented that I think that, you know, you're going to start to see those rainy day accounts dry up pretty soon. I talked to several families who have seen their work income go down, and they're just not sure where they're going to be able to make it up.
So I have two responses. One is, this is from your article. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has said it will, quote, temporarily adjust its enforcement posture, close quote, away from the workplace raids that have characterized its Trump-era conduct. The Department of Homeland Security has, quote, declared farm workers, a lot of the undocumented, essential, offering rare and extremely self-interested recognition of one of the many vital roles that America's shadow workforce plays. Meanwhile, the administration has used the crisis to turn away thousands of migrants at the southern border, including children and asylum seekers. So this is, I feel like they're cherry picking. Okay, you're bad, you're good, you're essential. We won't raid you, we won't pay you, but we won't raid you. I mean, you look at this and the hypocrisy of this administration is mind-blowing. But I want to go back to something I've said on this radio show before, and that is, after Hurricane Katrina, the Bush administration did something also, because they knew that they were going to need people to rebuild New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And they basically also kind of looked the other way and said, you didn't have to check the status of the people that were going to be doing the construction work in rebuilding New Orleans. So ironically, a lot of those construction dollars, which came from the federal budget, didn't go to, you know, technically documented or citizens. They intentionally understood that it would go to undocumented immigrants. Yeah. And they actually acknowledge that. And you're kind of telling me that, in an interesting way, so is Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that this has been a longstanding, strange double standard in the way that America treats undocumented immigrants, which is to say, and you know, and all the reporting I've done on this, I think, as somebody who is generally sympathetic to people who come to this country illegally, who cross the border illegally because they're fleeing violence and they're trying to make a better life, when I talk to people who believe that the federal government doesn't do enough to sort of stop this kind of immigration, and actually, that's basically true, that the federal government more or less acknowledges, that everyone knows, that the country would cease to function without these 12 million undocumented people. So the enforcement posture has always been one of sort of self-interest balanced with, enforcing the law enough to appease the kind of white nationalist crowd who wants to keep America white, right? So that there's always been a balance between those two things. But everybody knows, even the most conservative hardliners know, that if you were to get these people out of this country tomorrow, it would be a catastrophe, not just a human rights catastrophe for the people involved, but a catastrophe in this country for the people who remain, because that's how essential their work is. And I'm not just saying like literally essential work, like picking your food, but that's part of it. But just that they're totally enmeshed in the society of this country. They are our classmates and our friends and our
But Henry, tell them about how much money they pay into the Social Security Trust Fund.
Oh yes.
Oh my God. I mean, someday we have to make either the documentary or maybe the made for TV movie that tells the dirty little truth, because so many people are still in la la land thinking that they're just using us, that they're using our taxes, that they're using our educational facilities, that they're using us. They have no freaking clue that if they disappeared tomorrow, not only would you not have pork on your plate, not only would you not have lettuce on your plate, not only would your hotels not be clean and your hospitals not be clean, but guess what? Your Social Security Trust Fund would be going belly up.
Yeah, yeah, that is no doubt true, and I think that's kind of one of the many bitter ironies of this situation is that these people have paid a lot into the federal government and now they get nothing. Although I think that many of them I've spoken to, they don't really expect anything either. It's not like,
I know,
you know, they acknowledge that they have always been in a bit of a
limbo,
precarious situation here. And I think that to the extent possible, they prepare, although many of them are also very poor. They're proud of being self-sufficient and of being net positive contributors to the country they've arrived in. And but the truth is, you know, if we have to go 3-4 months where the types of jobs where undocumented people work really dry up, which is to say, the service sector, food service, some sort of construction work, all these fields, we're going to start to see a human rights crisis, because these people, I mean, it's a public health emergency, right? Like we need these people to feel comfortable coming forth. If they feel ill, we need to feel them to feel, and most importantly, perhaps we need them to feel comfortable staying home from work,
right?
If they feel ill and knowing that they're not going to get thrown out of their apartment for missing a shift, if going to a shift might mean spreading COVID-19.
So there's a couple of things that are going through my head. One is that one of the lines in your piece was based on a headline at the Wall Street Journal, that 1/3 of renters in America did not pay their rent in April. I can't imagine what the percentage is of undocumented immigrants, given the fact that they're not going to get a $1,200 check. They're not going to get, do they qualify? Here's my question. If you are working with a false Social Security card, and because they are paying into the Social Security Trust Fund, if mm-hmm. you lose your job, are they able to collect unemployment?
You mean the person whose Social Security card you've been working with?
Yeah, exactly. So you're an undocumented immigrant, but you have a false Social Security card, which is really how your employer gets to wink and nod. He probably knows you have a false mm-hmm. Social Security mm-hmm. card, but they've been paying taxes into the Social Security Trust Fund. If that person gets a pink slip and loses their job, because they've been operating under this illusion of citizenship or this illusion of a Social Security card, do they qualify for unemployment?
I do not think that, I mean, no, undocumented immigrants do not qualify for unemployment.
Okay.
If you're the grandmother who holds a Social Security number under
okay.
which your, you know, your relative has been doing work, that,
right.
that might be another question.
Okay.
Know.
Okay. So, but the reason I'm saying that is so we know that they're not going to be able to pay the rent. We know that they probably don't have health insurance. The question of COVID-19 and all the coverage isn't going to apply to them, but they're going to get COVID-19. They could infect everyone. They may be afraid, as you point out, not to stay home. But because they also are undocumented, they don't have access to maybe an expanded food stamp program or the Medicaid program. So I am kind of curious, did you talk to, especially mayors, where they know they have a significant population within their city, that obviously are so vulnerable because of this, how they are thinking about that silo of a problem versus all the other problems they have? Because if they don't deal with that, it just exacerbates everything else. And the reason I even ask that is I go back to what Bill de Blasio did in New York, Bill de Blasio decided that they were feeding kids who were no longer in school, and they were feeding them maybe one or two meals. Then they decided they would feed them three meals a day. Then they decided that their families could come and get free meals three times a day. And then they decided that anyone can come and get three squares a day. And that means anyone, Henry. And I think even though he didn't say it out loud, he was really talking to the undocumented community in New York, saying, I'll make sure you don't starve because this program is in place for everyone. We don't ask questions.
Right. Well, you've seen the lines, I'm sure, the aerial photographs of the food bank lines in places like San Antonio, where people are showing up in their cars and the lines go around the block through parking lots, hundreds, thousands of cars waiting, waiting for food bank assistance. So there is no doubt that the crisis is general and that where groups are setting, you know, coming up and providing help, families are lining up. And I should say, like, a lot of families are mixed status, right? So you might have a son who's undocumented, but a sister who's a U.S. citizen, and that's the situation that many, many families find themselves in. So somebody may be eligible for assistance, somebody may not. I think to some extent because some of these people work in fear of immigrations and customs enforcement, those kind of support networks have always been really important, but never more so than right now. With respect to the officials who are setting up, standing up and providing help like what's happening in New York, I live in Chicago, and the mayor of Chicago set aside a bunch of small grants and said that that undocumented families would also be eligible for these grants, and they had 83,000 families apply for 2,000 grants. So that gives you a sense of the scale of the problem here. I mean, I guess if there's one good thing we can say about a third of Americans not paying their rent, it's that people feel they've made a correct decision about, you know, which maybe the place not to pay the bill, right? Like, you know, evictions are all on ice right now in most cities and states, and I think that, you know, I would, given the precarity about we know about when income is coming back, I would say save that money for groceries and for healthcare and right. for even your cell phone bill before you give it to your landlord.
Right, and it's interesting. I posted that headline from the Wall Street Journal and a link to your article at Slate, and someone I know, actually someone who works on this radio station, by the way, Henry, she has like no income and she can't pay the rent, and she said, so I explained it to my landlord, and he said, well, pay what you can.
Yeah.
Everybody gets it. In a way, her cover is that one third of the American people have not paid the rent. In a way, it's not like you're a bad person or you're lazy or you just don't want to pay the rent. It's that he's never had that experience with her before. She's always paid the rent before.
Right.
But now, because we're all living in this incredible bubble, the fact that nobody can pay rent or so many people can't means that landlords have to figure out what to do, and they may even apply for some aid, which is what I want to talk about you next, because they're small business people. But where is she going to go? There isn't a rental assistance program yet.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that the scale of the crisis is so widespread that in some places you may see landlords striking deals because they're just thinking, well, if I move to evict this person for non-payment of rent, I could be looking at 6 months of no rent.
And exactly.
And it's particularly true in Chicago and maybe in New Hampshire too, where the housing market has a little bit of slack in it. That may be less true in some place like New York where housing costs are very high and right. landlords may feel more optimistic, but even there, I don't think anybody's renting a new apartment right now. So, that goes for restaurants as well. I think restaurants are realizing that, you know, despite the way the contracts are written, they may have room to negotiate with their landlords here because, again, if a landlord moves to evict a restaurant, I think we are going to see a real contraction in the restaurant industry, and it's unlikely that there's going to be people lining up around the block to rent one of those storefront spaces if they do decide to evict their tenants.
But if they evict their tenants, it's a restaurant. I mean, just the cost of transferring it into something other than a restaurant. I mean, in a way, you have to, nobody knows where the future is. Nobody knows how long this is going to last. Everyone's going to have to start figuring it out, which is why this is a great segue to Article Numero Due. And this is at Slate.com by Henry Graybar from Moneybox. Why the government's plan to save the economy is flailing. Well, blow me away with a feather, Henry. I think anything coming out of this administration would be flailing, not only because it's so hard to come to consensus, even during the time of a pandemic, between the Democrats and the Republicans, but then you have an administration that isn't exactly helpful. You did a fabulous Q&A with Jonathan Weissman, who's Slate's senior business and economics correspondent and has been reporting on the federal response. Let's just go through a couple of sort of the things that you found the most provocative in your Q&A with Jonathan, because I wanted you to answer every single question out loud so they could hear them all. But the first one I think is important. And you wrote, the CARES Act is the big coronavirus relief bill totaling $2.3 trillion. And the question is, you asked, how is that going? And I'm just trying to figure out whether they're actually going to get the checks out. Not that they're not going to eventually get there, but how long is it going to take to get there, Henry?
Who knows? Yeah. Some people have gotten their checks already. I will say, if you have your direct deposit information on file with the IRS and you're owed a check, then I think you've gotten it. But the larger question is, even when Congress decides to do something totally unprecedented, like send $1,200 to every man, woman, and child making under a certain amount, right, which is more or less what they did. The big question is about the infrastructure to distribute that money. And, you know, public services are only as good as the delivery mechanism. And I think we are going to see that more and more as we try and ramp up public health testing and, you know, coronavirus testing in this country and the general public health infrastructure. But it's true for financial aid as well. You're seeing that with both the coronavirus stimulus checks and the small business aid and unemployment insurance, all three of those programs, which are supposed to provide aid and have been generously funded, although the small business thing is now out of money. But all three of those things were supposed to provide aid to a large number of people. And they just haven't been able to run it well enough to get help to people who need it immediately. Okay, and I don't know if they're ever going to find, for example, people who are homeless, older people, people who don't speak English. Are they ever going to get checks if they moved last year? You know what I mean?
So let me just say something. So I'm hearing about the unemployment. So I want to talk a little bit about that. So the unemployment check, it sounds incredible. Not only do you collect your unemployment, but they give you an additional $600 a week. And for some people, that's more than they're actually earning. Okay. It's not like, oh my God, I've hit pay dirt for a couple months. Here's my problem. How much of the money that went into expanding those unemployment checks by $600 went into expanding unemployment offices? So I talked to a kid the other day who said, you know what I'm doing, Arnie? I'm making 30,000 calls a day to unemployment. I am trying to figure, I have not gotten through now in like, I won't even tell you how many weeks. And most of the offices have never been well-staffed. Most of the offices have never been slammed, ever have been slammed like they have. Did they put money in to enhance the state's ability to actually write the frickin' checks? Or do they just say, here's the extra cash? Because extra cash is nice. But if it can't get to someone in a timely fashion because you don't have the support system and you don't have the system in place, it's a dream. It just makes it very difficult for it to become a reality. So as they were proposing this, did they actually look beyond, we'll give you the extra money for the unemployment individual? Did they also recognize that virtually no state is prepared to handle the onslaught?
No, in a word, they did not. This is pretty typical. Imagine you're a governor of a state, times are good, and your idea for a big project with what to do with your extra money is to like revamp the unemployment insurance infrastructure that sort of underlies how that system rolls out. It's not sexy. It's boring. It probably won't even come in handy except in a crisis. And then all of a sudden, you know, to be fair, a once in a century crisis comes along, but they're caught flat footed. And I would say, you know, it's not just about unemployment offices. I've heard the same stories you have about people calling 500 times to try and get through. They don't have one of those numbers. Well, you know, like when you call American Airlines, well, they say they'll call you back. But this is a wider problem. And I would say that for anybody who has, for anybody who believes that government has the power to do good things for people, which I do, you know, and I support this sort of vision of governments using its powers to help people and help them get health care and help them survive a sort of stretch of unemployment or what have you. But you have to focus on the boring stuff too, the technical competence, right?
Oh God, like, but Henry, so that's my point though. So you hear Bill de Blasio, you hear Cuomo, you hear Murphy saying, you've got to put money into this bailout for states. You've got to put money into this bailout for cities. There's no question. But here's my problem. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that if you are suddenly going to see 10%, 20%, 30%, maybe even 40% unemployment, depends on which economist you're talking to, you know damn well at the federal level that the states are not prepared for this. You want to help them with extra money to get to the individual, but there isn't a state in the country that can handle a double, triple, quadruple number of people getting unemployment checks. How the hell do you write a bill that doesn't also include helping those states expand their unemployment response? To me, it's kind of like, that's the choke point. If you want people to feel stable and secure and not revolt and not live in terror, you don't just say, I'm going to give you extra money. You make sure that the system is in place at the state level, and every state's a little bit different. And that's where I always get so frustrated with the federal government, is that they have so many sophisticated people, but they never look at the gestalt. They kind of like, you know, think, okay, I'm going to solve this thing with one bullet. But you and I both know it's a patchwork quilt.
Yeah. And I will say, with at least with unemployment, you know, that those, hopefully those checks will get out at some point when things slow down a little bit. The part where I'm really worried is the small business loans. And they say they're bringing more money into that program. But my mother's a small business owner. And I think that I talked to her about it, and it's not even the waiting for the money to arrive, although obviously they need the money, but it's the nervousness of not knowing if there will be money, right? If they knew that in 2 months they were going to get a check to cover payroll, then it would be okay to hold out. But I think a lot of businesses, day by day, more and more will be making the decision, let's fire everybody, let's close the doors, because we just don't know if we're ever going to get these paycheck protection program checks.
So, and the other thing that we're finding out is that people that have already had relationships with banks, people who have sophisticated accountants on their staff, people who either work for law firms or whatever, they knew exactly what to do. They knew how to get in the door immediately. They had a pre-existing relationship. And most small business people don't really have that kind of level of sophistication. You know, it reminds me, and I only have a minute left, Henry, I worked on some banking legislation back in the 1980s. And I remember fighting this banking legislation. And one of the reasons I fought it was that I knew that the banking legislation wasn't written by us. It was written by bankers. How did I know? Because the day the law passed, the five banks I was most afraid of already had their completed application in. The day it passed. I mean, it wasn't like that the ink was dry, because they already knew how to get through the system. And that's part of the problem with small business, is that there are certain people who are on paper small business, but they have a level of sophistication that you and I know most small businesses don't. And they were able to access those dollars first, and they weren't the point. And again, it's kind of looking at the federal government going, they know what's going to happen. They could have predicted it, but they didn't address it. And that's, I guess, where I have this sense of disappointment that even in a pandemic, that someone couldn't have said, wait a minute, are you sure the money's going to get to who needs it first?
Yeah, so far it seems like it's mostly going to Applebee's.
Oh, shut up, Henry. I love you. Anyway, Henry Graybar writes for Slate.com. He writes at Moneybox. You have to go. I will link it on my Facebook page. You have to go to both articles. The Q&A with Jonathan is fabulous. So if nothing else, and we'll have to call you in a month because I'm sure we'll be able to do, you know, the third bailout, the fourth bailout, and then you can analyze it and I can get depressed. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm sure we'll have pandemic left to talk about. Thanks, Arnie. All the pleasure.
You're welcome.
Sad
all right,
to
ciao.
Say.
Yeah, night. Sad to say. All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Talk to you tomorrow.
I want everybody to listen. I want to talk about the rich and the super rich, the poor and the super poor. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Let's talk about it. Only six.